The following is a presentation from the North Carolina Reading Service, and it is... It's The Independent at Indie Week, and I'm John Federson here to read it to you. And it's a production for our blind and print-impaired listening audience. This issue is dated October the 8th of 2025. Now, this is being recorded on October the 8th, and that's a Thursday. The first article I have from Indy, the final results for the primary elections for Durham's mayoralty and city council. And here they are. As expected, incumbents advanced to the general election in each race. The big news of the night was challenger Shanetta Burris's substantial lead over Ward 2 Councilman Mark Anthony Middleton. In the mayor's race, Mayor Leonardo Williams and challenger Angenie Bell will move forward to the November 4 election. Williams maintained a wide lead over Bell throughout the night, finishing with 13,700 over 7,000 votes. In Ward 1, challenger Matt Kopach and incumbent Deidreana Freeman will be on the general election ballots. Kopach and Freeman traded top spots as the results rolled in, with Kopach ultimately eking out a 451-vote lead over Freeman. He ended the night with 40.89% and Freeman 39.05%. In Ward 2, Burris and Middleton will advance. Burris took an early lead and ended with 2,000 votes over Middleton. And finally, in Ward 3, incumbent Chelsea Cook and challenger Diana Medoff took the top spots, though Cook led Medoff by 34 percentage point, of about 8,500 votes. And these results are unofficial until certified. And this is as of the printing or online of October the 8th. Now, before we go on to a larger story about Apex and their governmental woes, an explainer about what the Durham City Council can do. It's been 2 decades since I sat in a high school civics class, writes the author. Dear God, but I don't remember cramming for any tests on local government procedure. Most kids learn about George Washington's cherry tree before they learn the name of their city's municipal leader. In Durham, residents must parse through an added layer of confusion to understand local politics. It's not always clear what falls in the jurisdiction of the city of Durham or its close collaborator, Durham County. Today, residents will narrow the field of candidates. This, of course, was written on the day of the election. To represent Durham on the dais at City Hall, and in just 9 days, voters will be back at the polls for the start of general election early voting to decide the final winners for mayor and 3 seats on the city council. While you can contemplate who you're voting for, or perhaps you might be crazy enough to consider local leadership yourself one day, here is a primer on city council, what power the council has, and places where council power is limited. The basics. City council members are elected on staggered 4-year terms, 3 at-large seats and 3 ward-based seats. Candidates must reside in the ward for which they seek office, but voters can select candidates in all 3 of the ward races. The mayor, however, is elected every 2 years. Durham has a weak mayor system, meaning the mayor has almost no more official power compared to the rest of the council. Their vote counts equally. The mayor does preside over meetings and gets asked to participate in more photo ops than their colleagues, so there's that. The city of Durham, along with more than 50% of cities nationwide, use a council manager system, which civics experts liken to a typical corporate structure. Voters, the stockholders, elect members of the city council, the board of directors, and the mayor, chairman of the board, who hire the city manager, who is the chief administrative officer. The council sets policies and enacts resolutions, appoints members to volunteer boards, and approves government contracts, as well as the annual budget each year. But city staff, with the city manager at the helm, are in charge of most day-to-day government functions, including services like public safety, transportation, and parks and recreation. Council may be the final arbiter, but city staff are the taskmasters, developing budgets and ordinances for the council to approve. If you've slogged through as many city council meetings as I have, you know that one of the main issues the council deliberates on is whether to annex land, either from the county or a neighboring municipality like Chapel Hill, into the corporate city limits of Durham, which entitles property owners to services like water and sewer, and potentially expands the city's public transportation network. In addition to annexing land, the city council can approve or deny rezoning requests that allow for different uses of existing property. If someone wants to repurpose a former industrial warehouse into hipster apartments, they need city approval to change the zoning designation from industrial to residential. That process is often when local residents have the most power to voice their opinions about a project. The city council can put bonds on the ballot, like it did in 2019, to help raise money that the city reinvests in the construction of affordable housing projects. Local officials can also make publicly owned land available for projects, giving the city more capacity to get affordable units built. Taxation. The city council levies taxes to pay for the city services. Every property owner is subject to property taxes, while commercial businesses incur sales tax, and for hospitality business like hotels, an additional occupancy tax. Durham County also administers its own taxes and is responsible for setting the tax base through property assessment and valuation process. Christopher McLaughlin, professor of public law and government at UNC, says there are a wide variety, many dozens of different full exemptions and partial exemptions. All of those decisions are made at the county level by a tax assessor. So the city has no say in the size of its own tax base other than expanding their boundaries through annexation. The county decides how much your property is worth. The city and county then decide the rate of taxation on that property. If your tax bill goes up, you should send your complaints to the county tax assessment office before showing up to City Hall. Limitations. At City Hall, you might hear councilors ask about affordable housing proffers during a typical rezoning case, and in response, a representative might say something like, "We've set aside 10 units for affordable housing at 60% AMI for 20 years. How they arrive at those exact figures is a question for an engineer or land use lawyer, but requiring affordable housing as part of a development, that's a practice known as inclusionary zoning, is a legal gray area in North Carolina, hence the proffers. State law does not explicitly prohibit the city council from using inclusionary zoning, but it doesn't explicitly allow it either. Chapel Hill has pushed those boundaries to varied outcomes, but so far, its inclusionary zoning policies have not been invalidated. The state constitution also calls for any tax exemptions, like those for nonprofits and some educational institutions, to be uniformly applied statewide. Durham cannot change or opt out of any of the exemptions, such as the one Duke University enjoys on its academic building properties. Since last year, a grassroots campaign called Duke Respect Durham, now seemingly subsumed by Durham Rising, has been putting pressure on Duke leadership and local officials to create a pilot agreement, or payment in lieu of taxes, a voluntary contribution from Duke each year that would support city and county programs like affordable housing and public schools. The law means local officials have little leverage to force Duke into an agreement, much to the dismay of pilot advocates. McLaughlin says the power they may have is the bully pulpit, but no legal authority to do so. Similarly, North Carolina's state constitution restricts how flexible a local jurisdiction can be with taxation. Local governments are prohibited from creating a tiered or progressive tax system. Whether you're rich or poor, black or white, married or single, you pay the same property tax rate. The city and county provide a handful of tax assistance programs aimed at low-income families, veterans, and the elderly, but these programs are by design targeted and don't reach everyone who could benefit. Finally, where does the city end and the county begin? The city council has become increasingly more intertwined with its counterparts, the Board of County Commissioners. Almost 50,000 people separate the city and county population. For comparison, over 500,000 separate Raleigh and Wake County. With the city of Durham as the only major municipality in Durham County, no one should be faulted for confusion about who does what, when, where, and how they do it. The city provides basic services like police, water, maintenance of streets, and trash pickup, among others. The county, responsible for social services like public health, helps pay for public schools and runs libraries, and oversees the jail. But the two government bodies collaborate on a number of programs, emergency services, planning and development, and transportation, among others, with shared staff and infrastructure. They go to many of the same meetings and contribute funding to the same projects. Throughout much of Durham's history, local officials, policy wonks, and concerned citizens have advocated for the merger of the two governing bodies, given the increasing partnership. The most recent attempt was in 2000. Logistical hurdles have been enough to stave off recent attempts. But as services overlap and the city annexes more county land into the city limits to accommodate Durham's rapid growth, there could be little distinction left. Next, from Apex, I should get to one of these major articles in this week's Independent. And it's titled, "The Apex Mayor and Town Council Are Navigating an Increasingly Strained Relationship." Apex Mayor Jacques Gilbert, or Gilbert, I'll say Jacques Gilbert, was trying to push through a nomination for the town's Board of Adjustment last month. Normally, the town council would sign off on such appointments with little debate, but on this night of September the 9th, things were going to be different. Several council members saw the nominee as someone who had riled up citizens against town staff in the past, and behind closed doors, they were telling the mayor they'd sink the nomination if he brought it to a vote. Months earlier, Gilbert had ended debate on that same nomination when it became clear he didn't have the votes. The kerfuffle prompted the Apex Town Council to update its meeting minutes to reflect that the mayor had apparently violated parliamentary procedures known as Robert's Rules. Councilman Brett Gant told the Indy, "I requested that he not nominate her so that we didn't embarrass this person." Gant is one of two outgoing council members who is not seeking re-election next month, which has freed him up to be more vocal on such matters than in years past. Now he and his colleagues are sounding the alarm on a mayor they see as pitting the public against town staff. They also worry that a Gilbert-endorsed candidate will make the council more deferential to the mayor. The two sides continue to butt heads on the response to a cyber attack that decimated the town's billing system last year. A private parking lot across the street from Apex Friendship High School, and much more. Meanwhile, an Indy Records request uncovered questionable reimbursements given to the mayor. The Board of Adjustment debate represents the latest in a string of public dust-ups between a fed-up town council and a mayor known for utilizing the political capital he has gained through his wide social media following. When Gilbert once again brought the same nominee forward last month, he hoped for a different outcome. If the town council wanted to reject his nominee, they'd also have to turn down a different person with whom they had no qualm, as Gilbert had bundled the two nominees together. This time, however, the council members stepped in to do something few have been willing to publicly: tell the mayor no. A council member began a motion to split the vote to circumvent the nomination. Gilbert stood up and interrupted. "We're going to recess," Gilbert said. "I need to go speak with an attorney." He banged the gavel and the live stream cut off. But footage from a backup camera later released publicly showed the frenetic scene that unfolded. The council proceeded in spite of Gilbert, declaring the mayor's attempts to unilaterally shut down debate out of order. Gilbert said, shuffling through papers, "There's unprecedented things going on." The town attorney weighed in and rejected Gilbert's call for a recess, and the glaring mayor was left dumbfounded. He recalls thinking at the time, "I can't believe this is happening." That was the look I had. I was like, wow, this happened so fast. The Indy spoke with 10 past and current town employees and local elected officials, many of whom declined to be named for fear of retribution. They all described an increasingly hostile relationship among the town's top brass and a highly demoralized staff. One town employee says it's kind of like being a child of parents divorcing. Another employee compared the mayor to a child throwing a fit at a candy store after a parent denies them something they want. "He throws these spells of outrage because he's not getting what he wants," the person says. A third source adds, "The mayor has been a loose cannon." Asked if he knew any town employees who could speak to his defense, Gilbert said he'd spoken, quote, "with several staff members willing to speak on his behalf." He says, however, they're extremely nervous that their names could get back to the town manager or senior staff who have influence over their careers. They've heard from other employees who have worked with certain council members to attempt to defame my character. The Indy offered to provide the same anonymity to protect those individuals. Even so, no town employee came forward to speak favorably of Gilbert. During a Friday phone interview, Gilbert further questioned the timing of the criticisms leveled against him. "Come on, man, you know this is election season. The timing is interesting." Shortly before this story was published, Gilbert posted a 7-minute video on Facebook downplaying the divides within the town. He told his followers, "No matter what opposition or distractions arise, my focus will remain on the community at large." Town P cards, that's the initial P cards, are usually reserved for lower-level staff to cover small purchases like food and gas. Gilbert already has a stipend, and unlike the mayor, no sitting council members have a P card. An analysis of the mayor's P-card purchases since 2024 showed Gilbert paid $375 to a porta-potty company, $340 to a local arts and crafts store, $400 to a hotel in Wilmington, $600 to a Hilton hotel, and hundreds of dollars to local restaurants. Gilbert says he rented 2 porta-potties for a town event at a park without restrooms, bought backpack tags for elementary school kids taking field trips to the town, and dined and traveled for official town business purposes. One employee informed of the purchases by Indy replied, "The porta potty is certainly a head scratcher." Gilbert clapped back, "To ensure the dignity of our residents, yes, I did it." Now, officials and council members say while the P-card purchases may not necessarily be illegal, they were questionable. Gant says no elected official should have such purchasing power, saying it can be kind of easily abused, so it's better for none of us to have that. These things get people in trouble sometimes. Others saw a larger concern being a pattern of the mayor reaching unilateral decisions and seeking permission later. Town Council member Arno Zegerman said, "The mayor has used that card in ways that may be perfectly legal, but at least questionable, because they have not gone through the proper control system we have in place that governs the purchases we make on behalf of the town." Gilbert says the town policies are unclear. Quote, "There's no process. There's never been a process to what they're talking about. I thought there was trust in the elected officials, which is why anyone can go look at the P-card transactions and challenge it." The mayor's reimbursement process isn't the only financial arrangement raising eyebrows. Gilbert announced an August 22nd news conference that he found a resolution that would allow Annie Scott, an Apex resident and property owner, to continue operating a for-profit parking lot in a residential area across from Apex Friendship High School. Gilbert said the State Department of Transportation signed off on Scott's continued operations through a special public vehicular access PVA designation. "It's a remedy other town council members see as false, disingenuous, and unlawful attempt to usurp zoning rules." Terry Mahaffey, one of the council members, says the lot needs to be rezoned and have fewer cars permitted to ensure student safety. He's since been in touch with outside experts. Derek Applewhite, a lobbyist for the North Carolina League of Municipalities, wrote in an email to Mahaffey, "We do not believe the state's designation of private property as a PVA preempts local zoning." Scott says she thinks Mahaffey and others are pushing her to rezone for the town's financial gain and to force her to move. Scott says she's rented out her yard for extra parking since the school opened in 2015, and she charges $300 for the school year, which is $100 more than the Wake County Public School System rate. Scott says they wanted me to rezone for them to collect high taxes. Meanwhile, around the time of the announcement, Scott donated to the campaign of T.J. Evans, the partner of Gilbert's daughter, father of his grandson, and the only candidate he's endorsed thus far for next month's town council elections. Campaign finance records show Scott gave Evans' campaign $900 across three payments in August 16, 25, and September 1. Zegerman says it might not be illegal, but ethically not looking good at all. It is a very, very slippery slope. Annie gets help from the mayor and T.J. Evans and subsequently makes some substantial donations to T.J.'s campaign. That is a huge red flag. Gilbert and Scott deny any suggestion of a quid pro quo. Scott says while she greatly appreciated the mayor's assistance, she donated to Evans because of a nephew's friendship with him. Scott says, "If I knew someone else that was running for the town council that would have been as nice to me as T.J. was, I would have helped them too." Gilbert added there was no coordination between him and Scott on the donation. Gilbert says what T.J. Evans and Annie Scott have going on, that's between them. "She does not support my campaign. She has never supported my campaign, but she is a person in this community who can contribute to whoever she wants to." Evans called the speculation of impropriety ridiculous and cited his record of civic engagement and volunteering in Apex. He believes the concerns are being raised to undermine his candidacy, saying, "I think it's very clear what's going on here, given the time that we're in right with the election season coming up." There's perhaps no greater disconnect between the mayor and staff than the issue of utility billing. In 2024, a cyber attack crushed the town's billing system, which impacts Apex's ability to create utility bills, showing accurate usage for the months of July and August. The attack could not have come at a worse time. As the town worked to recover, residents began receiving much higher bills than normal. This increase occurred for a number of reasons, both related and unrelated to that ransomware attack. First, utility bills are often higher in the summer, as usage of water and air conditioning noticeably increases. Second, the town adopted a budget a month earlier that would implement rate increases of 4% for water and 14% for electricity starting in July. And third, because of the ransomware attacks, customers received one invoice in September that was designed to cover expenses for anywhere from 2 to 3 months of usage. The town released a fact sheet to try to be more proactive in explaining the problem, but the messaging came too late, reached too few people, and became overshadowed by news reports and social media posts from the mayor. Employees repeatedly found themselves unable to get ahead of a problem that they felt Gilbert exacerbated through his 12,000-person Facebook following. The mayor repeatedly called it a crisis, and at times amplified issues on social media without first speaking to staff or vetting the accuracy of residents' concerns. This only increased what was already a high call volume following that cyber attack. A staff of around 6 people was left with the fallout and became inundated with angry calls from residents who saw Gilbert's post and suspected there was an issue with their bill as well. Some people had legitimate issues with their utility bills, including residents who moved during the summer, saw their meters break, had solar panel credits, or didn't have their bills transferred to a new account holder. For many others, however, it was simply the combination of rate hikes in a new town budget, increased summer usage, and bundling of multiple months into one bill that caused a surprise. One employee says it would be accurate to compare the mayor's handling of the issue to the folktale of Chicken Little, exclaiming, "The sky is falling." The town started to turn the corner on these billing issues earlier this year, but several employees continue to feel repeatedly undercut more than a year later, as Gilbert continues to provide updates on his Facebook page labeling utility billing issues as a crisis. Gilbert says, "I know people don't like that word, but for seniors, single moms who can't afford these bills, it's a crisis to them. I've had people in my office crying. Adults, you can check all my messages, and in all my messages I've always said staff is working hard. This is not against staff." Audra Killingsworth, another outgoing council member, sees things differently. She says, "I'm frustrated with all the levels of misinformation that are coming out." She points to a post on September 24 when Gilbert, in the comments section, alludes to a lack of cooperation amongst the council members and town manager to taking a different approach to solving the billing issue. And as many have pointed out, Gilbert's assertion that the PVA designation has resolved Scott's parking dispute is factually untrue. Killingsworth says, "I'm frustrated with blatant lies that are being posted to stir up trouble." Gilbert isn't up for re-election himself this fall. Indeed, some council members retiring this year may feel more emboldened to speak up as a result of their imminent departures. While many council members are concerned about what Evan's ascension could mean for the town, particularly contentious appointment, zoning, and development votes, they say they're far more concerned about social media posts the mayor has made about utility billings, abrupt news conferences over zoning disputes, and other issues that have negatively impacted staff. 4 of the 5 council members in town spoke to Indy on the record. Ed Gray, the mayor pro tem seeking re-election, was the only member who didn't respond to a request for comment. Gant and Killingsworth are retiring at the end of their terms this year, in part, they say, due to frustrations with the mayor and a sense they've done as much as they can for the town. Mahaffey and Zagerman, whose terms expire in 2027, said they felt a need to come forward with their concerns over what they see as increasingly destructive behavior from the mayor. Zagerman saying, "Morale with staff right now is terrible. Staff has clearly expressed to the members of council frustration with the persistent meddling of the mayor in operational affairs. It has led to attrition. Meanwhile, a former Apex official says they wished council members would have summoned the courage to speak out sooner. This former official says, for too long, the council members have not stood up and taken actions that were necessary for them to take to stand up against the mayor. The council holds the power. It shouldn't take two of them announcing they're not running for re-election before they start standing up and doing the right thing. Well, over to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, a professor, Dwayne Dixon, has been reinstated after the university placed him on leave at the end of September, following reports that Dixon was involved in an anti-fascist organizing through a now disbanded group. Dixon's removal from the classroom drew criticism from the UNC and Chapel Hill communities, as well as from the ACLU of North Carolina, which demanded UNC reinstate Dixon by 5 p.m. Friday, October the 3rd, or it would take legal action on his behalf. The ACLU's letter said Dixon's treatment was a blatant violation of the First Amendment and Fourth Circuit precedent. Dean Stoyer, UNC's Vice Chancellor for Communications and Marketing, said in a statement that Dixon was reinstated because the university had, quote, concluded a thorough threat assessment. We have found no basis to conclude that he poses a threat to university students, staff, and faculty, or has engaged in conduct that violates university policy. The university continues to reaffirm its commitment to rigorous debate, respectful engagement, and open dialogue in support of free speech, while fulfilling our responsibility to protect physical safety of the Carolina community. Unquote. Dixon, a professor of Asian and Middle Eastern study, was formerly a member of a, quote, anti-fascist, anti-racist community defense formation, unquote, called Redneck Revolt, and has previously been charged with bringing a rifle to a rally in downtown Durham. That charge was dropped, and Redneck Revolt's website says it has been disbanded since 2019. In a statement to the Indy, Dixon confirmed he was reinstated earlier today and thanked community members who stood up against his removal. Quote, the actions of UNC's leaders betray what I had believed to be shared values in the best traditions of this institution. The actions of the administration signal to faculty and students alike that we should think with trepidation and speak with fear, lest some unnamed accusers target us for administrative discipline or with threats, or worse. I will not be intimidated. With the solidarity and help of so many, I wish to enact another possibility, one of vibrant, conscientious, ethical engagement without fear of reprisal or silencing. Now I will give a little time for Indy Selects, What to Do in the Triangle this week. This is Thursday, October 9th, when I'm reading this, but you won't hear it till October 10th, and so I'm not going to read that one. I'm going to continue. There's a lecture series called Blue Whales, Discover the Origins of One of the Ocean's Giant Whales. This is a lecture at the NC Museum of Natural Sciences in Storr and Raleigh and the Nature Art Gallery. It's a paleontologist and Professor Mark Ewan, whales, terrestrial ancestors, etc. The lecture, which when I'm recording this is today, but you won't hear this broadcast, it's an evening viewing of a blue whale special exhibition. Tickets are $15 for that lecture and $5 for member. Well, why am I reading this? There is a four-part lecture series at the Museum of Natural Sciences, and you would go to the museum, their website. But there's a four-part lecture series, $45 or $15 for members. All right, next, beginning Wednesday, October 8th through October 20th, at the Gillings Center for Dramatic Art in Chapel Hill, The Wolves. Growing up, I didn't play sports, but always looked up at soccer players with their sweaty camaraderie and shower slides and cool sense of self-possession, or at least what I interpreted as such. Sarah Delap's award-winning play, The Wolves, explores the intricacies of one suburban soccer team composed of 9 teenage girls, with New York Times writing in 2016 that scary, exhilarating brightness of raw adolescence emanates from every scene of this uncannily assured first play. This is at the Playmakers Run. It's directed by Aubrey Snowden, with previews, which cost slightly less, running October 8th through 10th and October 11th, opening night. Tickets start at $20. Joan Gillings Center for Dramatic Art in Chapel Hill. To hear Beats and Bars Festival in downtown Durham at the Pinhook. This is Friday night, October the 10th. That's who you'll hear this broadcast. Beats and Bars is back for the 9th year. Homegrown North Carolina R&B and hip-hop to historic Black Wall Street and the Pinhook. Pinhook event tickets are $20, and you can find the Pinhook website and pay in advance, or maybe it's at the door. Artist installations, food and beverages available. Next, Splatter Flicks. That begins Friday the 10th through October the 16th at the Carolina Theater in Durham. If you want to celebrate the season with a little or maybe a lot blood and guts, Carolina Theater playing a week of horror films, including classics like Alien and The Thing. It's part of the theater's retro film series, old school films and classics back to the big screen. To see an individual film, a ticket's $12. But for aficionados of the genre, or for those with a stomach for gore to see more horror showing, they offer a $100 10-film pass. Check out the schedule at the Carolina Theater Durham. Finally, Sleepy Fest, Saturday, October 11th, in Saxaba Hall. Don't let the name fool you. 4th annual Sleepy Fest, put on by local label Sleepy Cat, will be packed with lively performances from North Carolina-based artists that are anything but sleepy. Before you go, take a listen to the artist playlist, and that's online at either the Haywagon Stage or Sleepy Fest. And it includes old-time, folk, Americana, cumbia, immersive electronic, a drag show, a puppet show, and twangy punk rock. Tickets are about $49.50 for adults, $22 for kids 6 to 12, free for kids under 5. All right, a fairly meaty article, at least it's long, about WRAL-TV. And this is a 1 week old, but I've held it along enough. I think it brings some important things for a media outlet that many of us, at least in the Triangle, or maybe even statewide, are very familiar with. WRAL-TV fights to succeed in a new media world. Posted above the double door entry to RAL's TV Raleigh headquarters is a quote from their founder, A.J. Fletcher: "To inform the public without bias or favor is this station's highest duty." Behind those doors is a warren of conference rooms, studios, control room, and a large open-plan newsroom. James Goodman Jr., the fourth generation president of WRAL and its family-owned parent company, Capital Broadcasting, strides down hallways filled with plaques and memorabilia commemorating the station's impact on local journalism. Inside the main control room, he looks on as a group of producers seated before an array of 15 monitors speak calmly but rapidly into their headsets, executing a complicated minute-by-minute choreography that is the 4 p.m. news. Next door in the studio, he watches as a pair of anchors prepare to go live, a breaking news barrier scrolling across the screen in front of their desk. A few minutes later, and one floor down, Goodman Jr. sits at a long conference table and absentmindedly rakes his hands across his face, pushing his rectangular glasses onto his forehead. He says, "I'm really proud of what you saw up there, and I don't really care if other people think that or not." He let out an exhale, somewhere between a wry laugh and an expression of defiance. He speaks about the family business in epic terms, he told Indy. This is a war, he said in a recent interview. This is a big battle we're fighting every day. Goodman Jr. is battling for advertising dollars against bigger, richer competitors. He's fighting to hold his audience's attention amid stiff competition from social media, streaming services, and AI-generated Google search results. And he's in a race against time, trying to predict the next trends and technological advancements in media to keep his station profitable and relevant. Much has been written about the death of print news in the digital age, but the business model for local TV news is breaking, too. Viewership has steadily decreased since 2016, according to the Pew Research Center, and advertising revenue has trended down as well, notwithstanding bumps from political ads during election years. Profit margins are slimmer than they were 30 years ago, to the point where the vast majority of local stations have been bought up by a handful of corporations. Of the local ABC, NBC, and CBS affiliates in the nation's top 25 biggest media markets, Raleigh's number 22, NBC affiliate is the only one that is not owned by a corporate parent like Sinclair, Tegna, Nexstar, or Disney. The last 5 years have thrown additional hurdles in WRAL's path, including a transition to a new chief executive and a string of high-profile departures from the newsroom and anchor desks. There have been casualties in Goodman Jr.'s big battle. Longtime employees who say they were laid off or offered steeply reduced contracts, and others who left the station abruptly and without explanation. They say WRAL is losing some of the family culture that distinguished it from corporate-owned competitors and helped keep viewers loyal. Asked about the departures, Goodman Jr. said some staffers had been resistant to change. He said, this isn't a kindergarten. In order to succeed, you got to adapt, you got to change, and you can either embrace that and become curious, which is what we want to do, or you can resist it. We've probably been overly considerate as it relates to overlooking those that have been resistant over time. In spite of the headwinds, WRAL is still relatively well-positioned. It has a newsroom staff of 143 and a host of profitable companies under the Capital Broadcasting umbrella to cushion the TV station against financial stumbles. The station does consequential political and investigative reporting, and it regularly wins coveted regional Emmy and Murrow Awards. Its role as a public good has never been clearer as other news sources shrink and disappear. WRAL makes its own decisions and, to some extent, controls its destiny. Sinclair and Nexstar recently told their more than 60 ABC affiliate stations, including WXLV in Winston-Salem and WCTI in Newbern, not to air Jimmy Kimmel Live after the host's comments about Charlie Kirk's death. Goodman Jr. has no faraway corporate boss to answer to. Sinclair and Nexstar said Friday they were bringing Kimmel back, by the way. Rick Edmonds, a media business analyst for the Poynter Institute, a non-profit journalism organization, says WRAL is, both in terms of its record through the years doing news and its economics, atypical of the whole universe of local stations. Very few are that dominant in the market, and very few have as big a commitment, at least historically, to doing some pretty ambitious news. The business model may be changing underfoot, but Goodman Jr., 48, who's better known around the station as Jimmy, is sanguine about WRAL's prospects. He said, I really want Capital to be doing local news in Raleigh 100 years from now. I don't know what that means. I don't know what device it'll be on. I don't know if it'll be here or Mars. But at the end of the day, when the dust settles, if we're not here, they'll find me with my knuckles broken. Fletcher, who founded Capital Broadcasting Company, CBC, was Goodman Jr.'s great-grandfather. He began amassing local media properties in the 1930s with the purchase of an AM radio station. In 1956, he branched into television, securing the license to Channel 5 and founding WRAL-TV. By the time of his death in 1979, CBC also owned the Tobacco Road Network, the North Carolina News Network, Capital Publications, Capital Broadcasting Network, and Seaberg Music Library, Incorporated. Fletcher also had an eponymous charitable foundation and a slate of broadcasting awards to his name. He was succeeded as CBC president in 1966 by his eldest son, Fred, who, in addition to serving as president of CBC until his retirement, was a community fixture in Raleigh. He was elected to the city council and chaired various Wake County Parks boards for decades. James Fletcher Goodman Sr., Fred's nephew, took over as president of Capital in 1975. Goodman Sr. made prescient bets on emerging technology. WRAL was the first TV station in North Carolina to get a news helicopter, 1979, and a satellite truck, 1984, the first in the Triangle to launch a website, 1996, and the first in the world to air an all-high-definition newscast. That was on October of 2000. Lee Meredith, an adjunct instructor at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill's School of Journalism, says they were probably the leading station in the entire country, certainly one of a handful that was very aggressive in moving to digital outputs. WRAL's early move to digital involved a substantial investment that Goodman's corporate counterparts, motivated by their bottom lines, were reluctant to make. Ed Crump, who joined TVD and ABC 11 as a reporter in 1984 and stayed for 37 years, said, "Back then, every local TV station just made money hand over fist and tried not to give any to their employees if they didn't have to." Meredith said the calculus was different for RAL. Quote, "One of the biggest pros of local ownership is a focus on serving this local community. They can decide how much profit they're going to make and how much service they're going to provide. In a big company, that's not going to be a local decision." The investments paid off. Under Goodman Sr., the station was widely lauded as the best in the region, beating out its neighbors, WTVD, ABC 11, owned by Disney, and WNCN, CBS 17, owned by Nexstar. Dwayne Bolin, a sports anchor for Channel 11 in the 1980s and 90s, said, "We may have been breaking the same story, but more people were watching WRAL, and that was a fact." Also, during Goodman Sr.'s tenure as CBC president, the company bought the Durham Bulls minor league baseball team, sprouted a real estate division, and redeveloped Durham's abandoned American Tobacco Factory campus into a multi-use district. Jimmy's brother, Michael, runs the company's real estate and sports division. The elder Goodman wanted Jimmy to learn every part of the broadcasting business he would one day lead. So, in the 90s, Jimmy started working as a camera operator for the 5 a.m. newscast. He was 16 years old. From there, Goodman Jr. bounced between different areas of the increasingly vast network of businesses, managing a handful of radio stations, acquiring new properties for the company, and leading CBC's new media group. In 2017, he became president and COO of CBC, and this May, he officially took over the CEO title from his father, who continues to serve as chairman of the CBC Board of Directors. "Dad, to me, is the GOAT," said Junior, using the acronym for greatest of all time. "Everything I learned about what we're up to comes from him. He sort of lives rent-free in my mind and heart all the time." But Goodman Jr. is operating on a different media landscape than his father. The generation of TV watchers who tuned in like clockwork for the evening news is aging. Younger people are much more likely to get the news from websites, apps, and social media than television, according to Pew data. Goodman Jr. says our audience are changing so fast, it's definitely become a more complex business in order to serve those needs. In 1995, WRAL broadcast 4 hours of local news every weekday. Today, that number has ballooned to 11 hours across WRAL and WRAZ. That's a local Fox affiliate that Capital Broadcasting also owns. Then there's WRAL News Plus, a 24/7 streaming channel that provides continual news and weather updates. Not to mention the mobile app, website, and multiple radio stations pumping out their own feeds of local news. More local news sounds great on its face, but there are a couple of potential problems with this strategy. For one, WRAL is still an advertising-based company, and digital advertising is far less profitable than TV advertising. Meredith called it, quote, trading analog dollars for digital dimes. Plus, WRAL doesn't seem to have expanded its reporting staff in proportion to its new multi-platform endeavors. The station would not tell the Indy and the Assembly, that's another publication, how staffing levels have changed in the last decade, but former employees say they watched their departments shrink even if they were as they were asked to produce more. Goodman Jr. pushed back against the idea that recent departures are anything more than the usual churn that all companies experience, and he said, "We've had a lot of people who left in my tenure. How I would compare that to now is it's the exact same as it's always been." Former staff tell a different story. The Indy and the Assembly spoke to several longtime employees who said they were laid off or offered steeply reduced contracts. Others said they saw the writing on the wall, left to their own accord for new opportunities. They say the station feels less like a family and more like a business than ever before. Nothing irregular in the competitive world of local broadcasting, but a departure from the RAL of decades past. Earlier this month, Laura Leslie, WRAL's Capital Bureau Chief, announced she was leaving the station to become the new editor at NC Newsline. That's a Raleigh-based nonprofit news site. Leslie spent nearly 15 years at RAL and became one of North Carolina's most authoritative voices on state politics. She declined to comment to the Indy about why she decided to make the move, but she wrote in an announcement, quote, "At a time when so many traditional media outlets are shrinking, State's Newsroom, that's NC Newsline's parent, is expanding its coverage of policy debates that affect readers' everyday lives," unquote. She added that she's grateful for the opportunity that the station gave me and the many skills I learned during my time there. Following Leslie's announcement, RAL News Director Mike Friedrich told News and Observer, quote, "She's been an important contributor for several years, but we are proud of our NC Capital team already in place." Some RAL veterans consider that disrespectful to Leslie. She's not the only recent high-profile departure. In March, Visual Design Director Sean Zhang, a 37-time Regional Emmy Award winner, left after almost 19 years, and he did not respond to a request for comment. The article continues for two more pages, which I believe my clock tells me I won't have time to read, so I'll cut to the end of this long article. Next Generation. When Indy visited RAL recently for a newsroom tour, rain was slanting down in sheets outside. Severe weather means a busy day of breaking news. RAL has 7 meteorologists and live updates for the news team, and the building was humming with activity. Goodman Jr., dressed unfussily in khakis and a navy Durham Bulls branded polo shirt, traded greetings with camera operators and producers as he loped down long corridors past banks of monitors. He stopped to point out a shiny new piece of tech, an automatic teleprompter that learns individual anchors' speech patterns and customizes the pace of its scroll. Back in the day, Jr. used to operate a manual version of that teleprompter during live newscast. "That position that I was in isn't here anymore," he said. "We don't have an operator anymore, but think about all the things we're doing now that we weren't doing." In one studio space, a reporter in a suit and a teenage camera operator in a headset were filming a traffic report. After they finished, Goodman ambled up to the operator and started ribbing him. "It looked a little shaky in the last shot," he teased. That young operator was none other than Goodman Jr.'s eldest son, Fletcher, who's 16. presumptive heir to the broadcasting empire blushed as his dad leaned in for an awkward forehead kiss. "There's nobody who wants things not to change more than me," he said later that day. "However, I realized very early in my life that's like talking about unicorns. Everything is going to change." Well, I have just 2 minutes left, and this long article is too long for it, but it's what does the federal shutdown mean for Triangle residents? And I will excerpt this severely. And we know what the shutdown is. Federal workers will bear the most apparent impact of these cuts. Many will be furloughed or asked to work without pay. And there's the Environmental Protection Agency, which I'll mention later. But what about government services? Municipal government and local school systems will be okay for now. And there's several paragraphs on what will be funded. That's the bottom line. They will be okay for now. Local EPA employees may be at risk again. That organization is facing steep staffing cuts. 90% of remaining staff are expected to be furloughed. A shutdown could provide an opportunity for the administration to turn furloughs into more layoffs. And let's see. Nutrition programs are currently continuing, but have been frozen in past shutdown, and those mostly WIC, Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, a 50-year-old federal program that provides food and support to pregnant, postpartum, and breastfeeding women, infants, and children up to age 5. Around the country, around 7 million individuals rely on WIC, implemented through local agencies. Now, at the state level, and then there's also SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance, which helps some 700,000 North Carolinians buy food, including about 34,000 kids in Wake County. And Deborah Ross, a congresswoman, says a prolonged shutdown of that could leave them truly without the meals they need to feed their families. Finally, WRDU does not anticipate any delay now, even with the TSA, are working without pay. And my time has expired, and John Federson for Indie Week will say farewell to you all. This is a podcast after our initial broadcast and can be found on our website, NCRS.org, North Carolina Reading Service. And so, for the staff of that wonderful service, we will be back with you in a week's time for another independent Indie Week. So farewell, everybody. Be back with you in a week.